You know, you speak about oral tradition and the passing down of music, and of course it varies from culture to culture how that's done. If we could just take a couple of minutes and pivot outwards. I remember when we worked together for the first time preparing the music for Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire live in concert, I was introduced to one of the projects at that time you were working on, which was collecting all of these great historical singing sounds and histories in your family. And you were working on putting them together in one beautiful project. This idea of handing down oral musical tradition through the generations is certainly part of that. And absolutely, when you have singing in the family that gets handed down, help us understand a little bit about that, because I had no idea until you kind of shared that with me personally, which I think about still from time to time. It's a beautiful thing. And as you say, you discovered that you couldn't believe the quality of singing with some of your ancestors.
Well, the thing is, from the moment you could utter a sound, our family would check you whether you could sing. I make a little joke about it. When people expect, they're waiting for their child to say mama or dada.
Yeah.
In our family, you were waiting for the kid to go dada. You know, it was like, can you sing? Oh, can you sing? Shut up. And you were condemned. You were condemned. Yeah. You were instantly Pavarotti at the age of 11 months, you were condemned. Terrible. It was like, because my daughter, Abigail, who's a beautiful singer, you know, and she's involved, she works with Simon Cowell, that impresario chap.
Yeah.
She is a wonderful singer, and she's sung in A Little Princess, she's sung in All Is True, she's sung many times, but she doesn't sing professionally, she's just part of the, and she's one of the many, 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 many amazing singers in the farm, just born with these. It's come from our DNA from all directions. Mm. I had a pleasant voice, you know. I was never the singer my father was, or indeed my mother. But I trained as a singer at the Royal Scottish Academy of Music, and I literally improved my voice with a great singing teacher, and his teacher was Herbert Cesare. And it's he's written many books, including The Voice of the Mind, which has nothing to do with support and breathing and all that sort of tension stuff, but it's about visualization. And it was the first time I come across visualization, which is now in the zeitgeist, sports visualization, you know, all that sort of training, mental training. This technique of singing is about visualizing your voice, your vocals doing something. You have a mental image and affect how the vocal cords, which are a muscle, work, and that way you're doing something. You're I suppose to take it down to its basic form, why is a great singer a great singer? You ask them what happens, and they say, what do you experience when you're singing Pavarotti? What do you experience when you sing like that? And you'll say, nothing. I feel nothing. I just do it. So the ultimate aim of Cesare was to feel nothing. So he absolutely flew in the face of all the support. So I can talk about pushing the diaphragm. It's all nonsense. I believe it's nonsense because, you know, my lungs can stretch from here to John O'Groats and with 6 weeks of deep breathing, and that habit stays with you throughout your life. But this stuff here, the minute you tense that up, problems come from the voice. I'm the only one in the family who studied it, but the rest of them just wake up and they do it.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's vocal. I hear sort of vocal faults emerging as I get older because technique solidifies it. That's why great singers then they have to have a technique, because if they're tired one day, then they pull their technique to get them through. Other days you feel on top of the world. You feel great in the morning. I mean, the first thing that happens when you're sick is the doctor goes, "Let's see your throat." It goes straight to your throat. It's the weakest part of the body at times. So that's why singers are neurotic and covering it all up. This is all part of my world. It's huge because We had parties, endless parties, and everyone sang. You were made to sing, whether you wanted to sing or not. Oh, he's a singer. She's a great singer. It's a great topic. Oh, you should hear her sing. You should hear him sing, yeah. As opposed to anything else. It was a priority. You know, whether they were, I don't know, a jolly person or a sad person, it was always, oh, what a singer. And my parents would go to clubs to hear great singers and to sing and be heard. So it was a gladiatorial. It was karaoke before karaoke was karaoke. But the singers were great singers. They weren't people having a go for drinking them. They went sober and they just sang sober. And it was a performance. It was a way of life, a local way of life. And it's still going on. So I was surrounded by this.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't until, it's a big long answer to this, it wasn't until I got older I realized, oh my goodness, I just totally take it for granted. And then when I got older, I thought, just a minute here, I have to start trying to possess some of this, you know.
Sure.
So, because people won't believe this, is that's what I'm doing. I'm just making sure I get recordings of what I can and clean them up and of aunts and uncles and everything else. Just to prove to the world, because I keep saying, oh my God, you know, my aunt's a great singer. People say, oh, sure. No, honestly, then I would let my friends hear them. They would say, oh my goodness, is that your father? Is that your, why isn't he a star? Why isn't she a star?
Yeah.
Well, they weren't interested. And that's the thing about greats. You know, a friend of mine's father was a very famous Scottish singer, and a guy called Robert Wilson. And Robert Wilson said to my friend, for every one person standing on stage doing it professionally, there's 10 better than the street. And I believe that. I've heard unbelievable voices, people who are not interested. One night, my father took me to a club. My father said, wait till you hear this woman. So she got up and she sang a Puccini aria. And I went up to her afterwards and I said, oh my God, why?
Yeah.
This is an international voice. I'm not interested. I've got 3 kids. I'm not interested. I've been offered 1,000 times to go to Scottish Opera. I'm not interested. You think, well, you can't force a person.
Yeah.
They've got to have the voice and the passion to let the world hear it.
Mm-hmm.
And these great singers who we all know, usually what accompanies it is this drive and ambition that takes us through 40 years of a career. I hope that's not too long convoluted, but that completely to this day surrounds my life. It's a huge part of my life. It is the absolute center of our family's existence. Who can sing and who can't sing?
Yeah, well, that's that handed down talent, as it sounds like you have in your family, that's been going on for generations. You know, I agree with you on the 10-to-1 ratio. You know, the street singers, the street performers. It's incredible how much raw talent there is in the world. Much of which has not been discovered in the way that we know, kind of. Through seeing just normal channels of distribution, right? I'm not sure if you've ever been to New Orleans. If you have, you may have heard her play. If you haven't, you got to go find her. I haven't seen her in a few years. It's been a few years since I was there, but every time I've been there since the age of, I think, 21, when we took a road trip from LA all the way to New Orleans with my friends in college, one of the greatest clarinet players I've literally ever heard in my life. And she plays on the same street corner, generally speaking, whenever she performs. She's got a washtub bass musician with her, someone playing rhythm, and unbelievable. And I remember the third time I ever heard her perform, I finally had the courage to talk to her. And I kind of asked her in a similar way that you asked the singer. I said, why aren't you out playing with Harry Connick or with Wynton or, you know, with any of these guys? And she says, honey, I've got a house in Florida, I got a house here. I got 3 houses. I get paid more here, you know. And she was so sweet. And but you know, I only laughed because, you know, for her, I could tell it was not just about the money. I mean, she played circles around some of the greatest jazz clarinetists I've heard, and of course, via a very different way. And not to take away from other people's talent, but to see her do this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I can just see her, you know, and you're right. That a wonderful term you used there, it's a very smart term about, you know, the usual channels of distribution.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, people sort of seek those channels and they get it distributed and people get into it. That's great. But, you know, fly, those channels are flying by people like that all over the world.
Yeah.
I likewise, you know, I can just see her totally content. No, no, that's what you want. You're projecting what you think you would want to happen to my life. But yeah. In fact, I've got it sussed.
Yeah.
I'm completely happy.
Yeah.
You know what I'm doing here? She says she's got all her home comforts. She plays. There's no one telling her what to do. She has all the choices.
Yeah.
You know, I've been very fortunate. I've worked on so many wonderful pictures and with great collaborators, and but they haven't all been smooth running. So I've been sometimes a gun for hire, and it's not pleasant. Not very often, thank goodness.
Yeah.
But she's no gun for hire. She's right. Got the gun and she's hiring it. So she's her own. She's her own. Voice in our own universe, and it's like my family who sing locally, and you know, the cost of living where they are is a lot lower than London. They've got a much bigger house,
yeah.
And people are living in huts down here and paying $500,000.
Yeah.
They've got a house with four bedrooms for about a quarter of the price. You know, the air's better, and they sing locally and have a great time for themselves. Wonderful life. And a fantastically huge community. It's a principality, and they're completely content and loving it. And look at me, like Lassie, you know. Why are you diving all over the world? What have you got to prove?
Yeah.
You know, and there's, you can't help but what you are, you know.
Yeah.
So you know, the older I get, the more and more I go back to that, and it's really enviable. I mean, I don't envy. I have a fantastic time, but that's not to be in any way to belittle what they do. Their lives are as rich as mine in many, yeah. many ways, and they've got that continual sort of support as a community, which is a real thing, and it's a very, very close community I come from, incredibly close community. It's unbelievable. We have a party. We have to keep the numbers down to 150.
Only 150.
But I'm not exaggerating.
Yeah.
But we hire a hall, etc. That happens frequently. So there are so many gifted people out there. They're just and they're very happy. Like, for example, my great friend's an opera singer, Janice Kelly, and she sings in film Great Expectation, which you mentioned. And Janice, she says the same thing. She knows so many fabulous sopranos and tenors and everything else who have sung maybe for 10 years, been amazing, and thought, you know something? I'm getting married, or I'm going here, and I'm off somewhere else. But why? That because I've had fun. I've had 10 years or whatever, I'm off.
Mm-hmm.
You talk, I had a great opportunity to have a lunch with Jonas Kaufmann. Through a friend of mine, he's an astonishing tenor,
yeah,
one of the greatest tenors I think has ever lived. And it was a real treat for me. It's the only thing I'm slightly starstruck is with great singers, very, very, very smart, intelligent, down to earth, and regular person, very nice. He was saying, you know, he's saying sopranos have a really tough time because great tenors are few and far between, if you've got a good tenor, well, you're in great demand, you'll work. But there are so many great sopranos that there isn't enough work for them. And the life as a soprano is so tough because there's so many of them that a lot of them fall by the wayside over the years who maybe want to carry on. And he says he's lost count of the great sopranos that the world has never heard. And
yeah.
those are the ones that are singing in great opera houses in the world.
Right.
So there are stories everywhere about that.
It's true. And, you know, I think as an artist, anyone really who's creative, you know, I think it serves us well to, if we have an experience such as seeing and hearing a street musician singing, you know, instrumentalist, whatever it is, being able to kind of think back and look at that through our own lens, our own context, and be reminded, right, that there are so many ways to be creative. And I think that, you know, I've noticed even just in the very young transition I've had from age, let's just say age 20 to now, as of last month, age 40. Oh, don't get me started on that, that psychology, you know, just in the last 20 years for me, having gone through the the desire to want to do one thing here, or one thing there, or another thing over here, and realizing now all these years later that, you know what, you may end up here, you may end up there, you may not, and whatever opportunities you have in front of you, you got to jump on them. You really got to jump on them. And I think that's one of the things that a lot of, and I noticed this with some of my colleagues when I was young, opportunities were lost because it wasn't an opportunity that they necessarily wanted to pursue, but they could have. And then, you know, you just never know. Going the other way might get back to where you want to be without yes. getting to where you want to be directly. And I think it's an important lesson to learn because so there's so many ways of being creative. And when we start to limit ourselves and how we choose to be creative, you may not ever get to where you want. I mean, yeah. you know.
I totally agree. I think I've found, you know, and I try to, I don't always adhere to this philosophy, but generally speaking, if you seek and pursue something that gives you, you know, as much pleasure as possible mm-hmm. artistically and without being put upon in the process, that's going to make your day fun,
mm-hmm.
and to be able to say yes to the right thing or no to the right thing or the wrong thing, and to say, well, no, I don't want to work this project because I know the what they're expecting, I can't give them what they want, or yeah. I'm not comfortable working with those people. You have to be very, 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 very circumspect and very, very confident in yourself, or follow your instinct. I'm sure you do the same thing. I've learned that your instinct, we don't tap into it enough as human beings.
Sure.
This sixth sense is yeah. absolutely on the bullseye every time you tap into it. If you learn to see that, okay, I'm lost. Right? When you start panicking, and I panic a lot when I'm traveling around. Okay, is it right or left? I've no idea where I am. It's before, you know, satellite, nav, it's the right. And sure enough, you find the right street, or you find the right restaurant, right. or, you know, there's something about your holy instinct, your body's instinct, and that happens to your choices in life. I remember I was offered a highly prestigious director and a film, and which just looked, and I thought, and I just finished a film and I was exhausted before computers were now, everything's by hand, it's just too much.
Yeah.
And I thought, I must go, I've got to have a holiday. So the family went on holiday too. We are very, very fortunate to have a place to go to in France. And after 10 days, I thought, oh my goodness, I'm feeling a lot better now. Oh, I turned down that picture. Oh, well, you know, that's life. And the phone rang and it was Robert Altman. To do Gosford Park. 10 days later, and I thought, now there you go. And this other film was not a success, and it was very troubled. And my instinct, I mean, there was no obvious sort of alarm bells in that respect.
Right.
I just knew I wouldn't be comfortable.
Right.
This film with Altman turned out to be an extraordinary experience, and even co-wrote a song with my daughter, who was 19, and she sang two songs in it, Abigail. And we became great friends, especially with his wife, Kathy, and after Robert died, one of the last suppers she had over here was at our house.
Mm.
So by saying no to something, which was very difficult, because my every sinew of my body was saying, no, don't do this.
Yeah.
And I've learned in life, if you can, and you're in a position to say no, if you aren't, then obviously you're, many, many years ago, I would say to yes, because I just had to keep working and pay the rent. But when something is screaming, you know, I can afford to, you know, even when I had very, very little starting out my career, I would say no to things. And my wife is so supportive. Things that actually plunges into sort of real sort of periods of struggle. And I just felt, no, I'm going to be deeply unhappy. I'd rather be unhappy this way or not unhappy like that. So yeah. I think if people try and keep that balance and follow the gut. Obviously, one has to be practical and realistic, but when there's an alternative and you can hang on and something's not comfortable and it's going to make you unhappy, then say no.
Sure. Yeah. 2005, another Mike Newell collaboration, Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. One of my favorite moments, I mean, there are so many favorite moments, and I just got to tell you, now that we're able to kind of look back and reflect on what I was just so humbled to be a part of, that amazing experience, you know, we had in Royal Albert Hall together.
Thank you. Wonderful job we did. Wonderful.
Well, it was a real pleasure to share this music with your home crowd, so to speak.
Yeah, you know, it was fabulous. In London. Thank you. It was a lovely box. Thank you very much.
Yeah, no, it was a really great experience. And I've had the luxury of being able to conduct this entire score a number of times and in a number of places. And one of my favorite scenes over and over and over, not only to conduct, but to emotionally react to and what it means to the film and what it means to just the art of composition in film, is this bizarrely uncomfortable scene where Harry is asking Cho to the ball, and it's filled with so much teen angst. Yes. It's bursting with angst in the performance, yeah, the content, and the way that you choose to approach it is with a flute, an alto flute, and some beautiful strings, and it gets you out of this awkwardness and into this beauty. And so let's just see what's and listen what's happening.
Okay.
Cho?
Yes.
I just wondered if you... I don't know if maybe you want to go to the ball with me.
Sorry, I didn't catch that.
I was just wondering if maybe you wanted to go to the ball with me.
Oh, Harry, I'm sorry, but someone's already asked me. And... well, I've said I'll go with him.
Okay. Yeah. Great. Fine. No problem. Okay. Good.
Harry! I really am. Sorry.
All of us have experienced, something similar in our life, right? And that's one of my favorite things, is that we all have our own story of this, right? what went through you here? I mean, what was your first reaction? And not the least of which is, how is this kind of, what was it being a part of the Wizarding World, J.K. Rowling's Wizarding World, as we now call it?
Well, it's extraordinary. Even though I'd scored many, many, many films, including some big sort of tentpole movies, big movies as they call them, tentpole movies, nothing prepared me, or still prepares me, for the enormity of this franchise and the phenomenon which it is. It's just unprecedented, and quite frankly, I wasn't. I went into it with Mike, knowing I'd worked with Mike before, and I knew that it was a big film, and there's the responsibility that goes along with it. But nothing like, I mean, we brought the Albert Hall and to see you up there and the orchestra, and to think, oh my goodness, this is. See, it was always my dream to have this, to have music live to picture. I always visualized this, as I said earlier. Here we are. You be careful what you visualize and wish for. In that case, it was just, that was one of the most extraordinary experiences for our family, to sit there and watch that. The Albert Hall, filled to the rafters, and this phenomenon, which is this franchise, and to be part of it, is a great, great privilege. And I put my heart and soul into it, as I always do anyway. And thank God, because the level of scrutiny has been extraordinary over the years, and here we are again scrutinizing it. But I always believe this as a composer, you have to, because I did a picture, I won't mention the picture, but another great director came in and he says, I saw blah 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 last night, and I said, put my head down. And the movie was not good, and he goes, and this person said, it was very tough, he goes, listen Patrick, you gotta do big American movies or American movies, but I loved your score. I hated the music. It's a pile of blah, blah, blah. But I loved your music. So, and this person, I was about to embark on this big movie with this guy. And I said, well, I didn't know you would see that. He said, I see everything. And that's the thing. Other directors, other artists, other great artists like yourself, people see everything you do. And even if it's like the products, the writing's not as good or the performances don't live up to it. If you... Because this director says, how do you write the film to the score to a bad movie? I said, I just imagine the movie it should be. And I imagine the performances should be, but with a great film like Harry Potter and a great director, such an assured, experienced director, and a great story and great characters, it's all there for the taking. And I really wanted to make it's quite an operatic score, and I wanted to. It's a much darker story, and the kids are no longer kids; they're young adults. I hate the term kids. I always like to say young adults. The young people in that picture are going through this horrible transition from, you know, puberty as you grow older. Yeah. It was a nightmare for all of us. It's really awkward, you know, your hands grow like some alien, feet are growing before you rest of your body, and you're bumping into things. And,
that's right.
It's horrible.
Yeah. Why do they have to travel in packs? And how are you supposed to get one on their own to ask them?
Tell me, Harry, you say dragons. If you can't get a date, you can.
I think I'll take the dragon right now.
All of that I completely understood and empathise and sympathise with. But to be part of this franchise is a tremendous honour. And as I say, it's still going on, it's ongoing. And but this particular scene, this is where I come up with the Harry and Winter theme, was this scene here. And I thought, I come up with a little melody. I wanted a little love melody between those two.
Yeah.
And it sort of swells up at the end. And the choice of instrument, I suppose, in a lower register and sort of breathy. Yeah. And you think in terms of that kind of the breathy instrument. So I thought of them as kind of, you know, as puberty is woodwind. Those are physical sort of things come into your head, that kind of breathlessness. you can't get your breath. And
well, there's a somber tone to it, right? I mean, the somber qualities of the instrument. How one of the things I love so much about the scene musically is how you pivoted and went the other way. You know, you turned this into a bit of, again, what is Harry really feeling here?
Yes.
He's probably a bit sad.
Capturing the essence of those two characters, and especially Harry, of course, it's about his awkwardness. She's just a witness, really. Witness.
Like, come again?
It's about his agony.
Yeah.
When she says no, you just play his love for her anyway. It doesn't matter. He's already given his heart away, so let it out over the mountain. So it's almost a kind of cry of love over her head as we see that mountainside behind. I suppose it's the old, you know, romantic in me as well. Yeah. I love a romantic story. I'm a big, I cry quite easily as a, I can watch a film and really sort of immerse myself and enjoy it just like a regular person that goes to see a movie with no preconceptions of how all the technical stuff works. I wanted to play his passion and his love for her. I didn't have a lot of time to do it because there's so much in that story to pack in. It was a little flourish of his of his romantic side. And David Heyman, the producer who found the books, he particularly loved this theme.
Yeah.
And so much so that I do this very often if I can. If I've got the time, I will write a concert piece based on it. So that's how that piece came about, because David Heyman loved it so much. I said, okay, I'll write this. It's not part of my contract, but I will write this as a concert piece, because you have the luxury of this great orchestra and a very generous budget. So it's quite expedient to do that. And then you've got it on the album. So they were very supportive and let me do that.
Brought to you by Cineconcerts.